One can only appreciate the sea change brought about in 1965 if one understands what happened in 665, in 965, and in 1265. This is one of the fundamental points that I'm going to want to convey in the course of this lecture series. What is not necessarily what was. We could only understand the is if we understand the was. The contemporary world, with all of its nuance and complexity, can only be appreciated if one is aware of important aspects of the medieval world. You expelled us? We're back, and we're still here. There were three components of messianism that characterized Jewish life during medieval times. There was messianic belief, messianic speculation, and messianic activism. I see these in a series of three ever-constricting concentric circles. The largest is messianic belief. Jews believed that one day the world as they knew it will come to an end, and that a Messiah will arrive and usher in a new era, when all of mankind will dwell in peace, brotherhood, and tranquility. The most famous expression of this belief was formulated by Maimonides as the 11th of his 13 principles of faith. The most well-known version of this text is as follows, and I quote, "I believe with perfect faith, ani ma'amin be'emuna shlema, in the coming of the Messiah. And although he may delay, I will wait daily for his coming." One messianic belief. Many Jews believed someday there will be a Messiah. The second smaller concentric circle was messianic speculation. In every century and in every geographic area, there were Jews who believed that it wasn't just enough to believe that someday the Messiah was going to come, but they believed that they could actually predict when the Messiah will come. Messianic speculation. The mechanism that they used to determine the date of the Messiah's arrival is known as gematria. And let me explain what that is. In the Hebrew language, letters are not just letters, Hebrew letters like A, B, C, but they're also numbers like 1, 2, 3. And so, for example, Aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, is also the number 1, Bet, the second letter, number 2, Gimel, the third letter, number 3, Yud, the 10th letter, number 10, Chaf, the next letter, number 20, and so on. Kuf is 100, Taf until the last letter is 400. And so gematria is the method of calculating the numerical value of Hebrew words. The words are made up of letters, but the letters are not just letters, the letters are also numbers, and drawing conclusion from those numbers. So here's an example, a specific example, that's going to bring us back to one of my previous lectures. In describing the service that took place in the tabernacle in the desert and that was later going to take place in the temple on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, the holiest day of the year, the Bible states, I'll say it in Hebrew and then I'll translate it, Bizot Yavo Aharon El HaKodesh, Bizot, with this. With this, Aaron will enter into the sanctuary. And what follows in the biblical text is a list of garments that would be worn by the priests when they minister in that holy place on that holy day. Bezos with this, and now I'll tell you what. They'll wear this kind of a garment and that kind of a garment. But in the 17th century, this phrase was understood as hinting at the year that the Messiah will arrive. And it was interpreted as follows. Bezot, in the year Zot, Aaron will come into the sanctuary. Now, Aaron coming into the sanctuary means that priests will once again minister in the temple, and this was a fundamental component, the rebuilding of the temple of the Messianic era. Bezot in the year Zot. The word Zot in Hebrew is spelled with three Hebrew letters, Zion, Aleph, and Tav. The gematria, the numerical value of Zion, which is the seventh letter of the Hebrew alphabet, is 7. Aleph is 1, Tav is 400. Bezot, in the year 408, 400 plus 1 plus 7, the Messiah will come. They assumed the sixth millennium, and so what we have here is the year 5408, which is the equivalent in the secular calendar of the year 1648. And so that means that there was an expectation that in the year 1648, Bezot, in this year, Aaron will return to the temple will be rebuilt, and the Messiah will come. But we know what happened in 1648. Not only did the Messiah not come, but Khmelnytsky came. The expectation of an imminent redemption was dashed, and in its place came cruel persecution. And so we're now in a better position to understand the incredible pain that was experienced by the Jews at that time. They were looking forward to the Messiah, and the opposite is what happened to them. So here's an example of how gematria, the numerical value of Hebrew letters, are used for messianic speculation. And there are dozens and dozens of examples of messianic speculation throughout Jewish history, all of which, regretfully, have been proven wrong. After all, the Messiah has not yet arrived. So we have messianic belief, the largest. We have messianic speculation, and now we return to and come to and focus on the smallest of the concentric circles, messianic activism. There were some 24 such examples prior to the 17th century, mostly in the Sephardi world. It was not enough to believe that the Messiah will come. It was not enough to know when the Messiah was going to come. But there were those who actually believed that the Messiah has already arrived. For example, Abu Issa of Isfahan in the 8th century, David al-Roi in the 12th century, David Reuveni, Shlomo Molcho in the 16th century. It was then in the 16th century in particular when messianism in general became more heightened. Ashkenazi Jews, you remember, had been expelled from Northwest Europe and were moving to Poland. Sephardi Jews had been expelled from the Iberian Peninsula and moved east to the Ottoman Empire, which included the land of Israel. World Jewry, Ashkenazim and Sephardim are on the move, and they're moving east. East meant one thing to Jews. East meant Israel. East meant Jerusalem. World Jewry is moving eastward. One of the fundamental components of the Messianic era, in addition to the rebuilding of the temple, was the ingathering of the exiles. And so Jews may not voluntarily want to come to the land of Israel, so God was arranging for them to come to the land of Israel. World Jewry was now moving inexorably one step closer to the arrival of the Messiah. In addition, I've already noted that the trauma of the Spanish expulsion led also to an increase in messianism. I noted that in times of stress, messianic antennae begin to quiver. When there is upheaval in the world and Jews are feeling extremely oppressed, they're thinking of salvation, they're thinking of redemption. How will we ever get out of this? How will we survive? Mashiach, the Messiah, must be coming. And so, in keeping with the notion of the ingathering of the exiles, and in recognition of the fact that kibbutz galuyot, this fundamental component of the messianic era, was now on people's minds, efforts were made during this time to search for the so-called 10 lost tribes of Israel, who were captured and sent into exile 2 centuries before the destruction of the first temple in the 8th century BCE and were never heard of again. They were totally removed from the perspective, from the parameters of world Jewry. But now, with this new messianic emphasis, efforts were made to find them in order to bring all Jews, wherever they may be, scattered throughout the entire world, back to the land of Israel to contribute towards the messianic arrival. And it is now that Ethiopian Jewry enters into the consciousness of world Jewry. They were believed to be from the tribe of Dan, one of the 10 lost tribes that were missing for forever. References to them begin to appear at the end of the 15th century, but there are many more now in the 16th century. Messianism now is in the air. I mention all of this first because this is a very important component of the medieval Jewish experience, and also because, and I mention it here, because the largest, most powerful, and most influential messianic movement in all of Jewish history was in the middle of the 17th century, surrounding the figure of Shabtai Tzvi. Here we have a movement which for the first time is not local. It's not limited to a few dozen adherents here or there, but it was truly international in scope, and it attracted tens of thousands of followers. And it is to this movement that I want to focus our attention for the remainder of this lecture. Shabtai Tzvi was born in Turkey in 1626. At a young age, he began to have messianic pretensions. He moved to Jerusalem and then to Gaza, where he met Nathan of Gaza, who in 1665 announced that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah. This is generally how it happened. The Messiah did not announce himself, "I am the Messiah," but someone else said, "He is the Messiah." The news spread, and this time, as opposed to every other time when this occurred in the last previous 1500 years or so, this messianic announcement was taken very seriously. Virtually all Jews, from Poland to Persia, from London to Livorno, Italy, Germany, Turkey, the Netherlands, the land of Israel, and elsewhere, prominent rabbis, private citizens, were this time convinced that, in fact, yes, it is now. The Messiah, in fact, has arrived. Hard-nosed businessmen unloaded their merchandise for the equivalent of a nickel on the dollar in major cities across Europe and prepared to leave for the Holy Land. Messianic fervor swept across virtually the entire world. And so we need to ask the right question. Ma nishtana ha-messianic ha-movement hazeh mikol ha-messianic movements? Why is this messianic movement different from all of the other, every single other messianic movement that preceded it throughout the Jewish historical experience? Why was this messianic movement so popular, while others that existed in the previous 1500 years were not? For many years, it was thought that this was the result of the trauma of the Khmelnytsky massacres. 1648, 1665, 1666. As we have seen, in times of stress, messianic antennae begin to quiver. The only way the Jews could get through this horrible tragedy, it was thought, was to believe that they're hearing the footsteps of a soon-to-be arriving Messiah. However, a number of decades ago, Professor Gershom Sholom, the internationally renowned scholar of Jewish mysticism, rejected this suggestion. After all, he argued that Shabtai Tzvi was welcomed as the Messiah by communities that were not directly affected by the Khmelnytsky massacres. Secondly, after all, he points out, Shabtai Tzvi himself was not East European. He was born and raised in Turkey. And so Sholom proposes, very interestingly, that the key to the popularity of this messianic movement, as opposed to any of the others that preceded it, was to be found in the relatively recent popularity of a version of mysticism that had in fact become popular and was capturing the Jewish world at that time. The reference here is to the Kabbalah, to the mystical traditions and positions of Rabbi Isaac Luria, known as the Ari, a prominent mystic who lived in Tzfat and Safed in the middle of the previous century. His version of mysticism was taking the Jewish world by storm, and his version of mysticism was permeated with an emphasis on the end of days. And so therefore suggests Sholom, everybody's now thinking end of days. Now the Messiah comes, so let's put two and two together, and maybe now this one is the real one, and we are now going to be convinced because of the backdrop of Lurianic mysticism with its emphasis on the end of days that the Messiah has in fact arrived. And this, suggested Sholom, accounts for the unprecedented success and popularity of what is known as the Sabbatian movement, the messianism of Shabtai Tzvi. More recently, this theory has also been challenged by some of Sholom's students. The world of scholarship continues. Old theories come under new scrutiny. Some of them are affirmed, and some of them are rejected. For whatever reason, this messianic movement exploded, and it soon alarmed Ottoman Empire authorities because it was causing unrest in the empire. The Sultan summoned Shabtai Tzvi and gave him a choice, and gave him an ultimatum. Either you convert to Islam, or I will kill you. And to the shock, and to the horror, and to the amazement of thousands of his followers, the Messiah converted to Islam. After this shocking conversion, the vast majority of the Jewish world who followed him recognized that they had made a terrible mistake. After all, it is simply inconceivable that the Messiah should be a Muslim. And so sadly and reluctantly, they returned to their previous lives. Downtrodden, depressed, and dejected. Imagine for a moment living at a time when you absolutely believe that never again will Jews be persecuted, the temple is going to be imminently rebuilt, the whole world is going to live at peace. It's idyllic, it's magical, and it's now, and I'm living in it, only to discover that it has been simply a cruel hoax. Most of them recognized the mistake that they made, and with great reluctance and with great pain, they went back to their previous lives. Hard-nosed businessmen crawled back into these incredible, what had been powerful communities that they now were so embarrassed to rejoin. They had to go try to do business again to pick up the pieces. but remarkably, a few continue to believe. They continue to believe that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah, even though the Messiah had converted to Islam. This was made possible through the efforts of Shabtai Tzvi's supporter and announcer, Nathan of Gaza, who constructed a highly creative post-conversion Sabbatean theology explaining or justifying this conversion. And a number of Jews found it to be compelling. The establishment Jewish community considered these persistent Sabbateans to be heretics, and they continued to be hounded by establishment rabbinic authorities well into the 19th century. I focused on messianism in general, an important component of medieval Jewish history. I focused on Shabtai Tzvi in the 17th century, the most prominent messianic movement of all. And with this ninth lecture, I have brought our story into early modern times. And it is to this time period that I will turn our attention in my next and final lecture. And so we have three groups. We have new Christians who came as new Christians and slowly began to identify as Jews. We have Jews who had always identified as Jews. And now we have Jews who lived in Spain, whose great-great-grandparents lived in Spain, but somehow all these years later felt something that was pulling them to see if there's any way that they could possibly live publicly as Jews in a Jewish community.